Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the conflict in conflict situation in Mozambique. I'm joined by a very special guest, Emilia Colombo. Emilia is a senior associate at the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and a senior security risk analyst at Voskroft Analytics. She's also previously a senior analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, where she covered African and Latin American political security issues. Emilia, we're very grateful to have you join us today. You've got a very wealth of experience in these issues, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yes. Let me start off by asking that. What is the conflict situation in Mozambique?
We're looking at a conflict that began in 2017. It seemed simple enough. Some fellows had been arrested and were in a local jail in northern Mozambique, in one of the most remote provinces of the country, and their fellows came and broke them out of prison, something that caught people quite by surprise. And it was sort of difficult to understand who were these people, what was going on. But in the intervening years, it's become quite clear. We're looking at an organization that was born out of the sort of political, economic, historic grievances and inequalities that are found in this province. In a country that is predominantly Christian, in this one province, we have a predominantly, or at least 50% or more, population that is Muslim. We see in this province, this province is the poorest province of the country, despite a lot of mineral wealth and the recent discovery of liquid natural gas, the largest investment in liquid natural gas in the entire continent, in fact. And these sort of these historic issues came to a head, in fact, with this discovery of the LNG, where you saw a population that had been suffering for so long have renewed expectations of potentially better economic conditions, better business opportunities, and they weren't realized. And that just built upon these decades of frustration over lack of political voice, of economic opportunities that was starting to impact even the way people were able to carry out their lives. On top of that, you do have this religious element. You had some youth who had become radicalized, who had become disenchanted, not just with the way Islam was practiced in Mozambique, but with the very leadership of their faith, who they felt had been corrupted through their relationships with the ruling party. And these issues came to a head. The local religious leaders were concerned about the development of this more radicalized group, sought assistance from the authorities, which eventually led to the arrest and of these fellows that launched this whole conflict that we see today. The insurgency was doing very well for quite some time. In March of 2021, however, they made a mistake. they bit off a bit more than they could chew, perhaps not anticipating the level of reaction that their attack would cause. They attacked the town of Palma, which had been the headquarters for this LNG development, where there was a large foreign presence. And for the first time, this conflict impacted foreign actors. And that at that point, there was no ignoring it, not when it's making headlines on CNN and BBC World News. And the government found itself somewhat forced to accept external assistance in trying to tamp down the violence that had been brewing now for years.
Very interesting. This sounds like another group that I've been studying that I've known to be one of the experts in the Boko Haram. This you've just told their story. It looks like you've just told their story. But you've been saying this, fellows. Do they have a name? I was gonna
ask you. They have many names. It depends who you ask. The acronym they go by is ASWJ initially. That was the sort of the acronym that they went by. Locals call them Mashababush. As their relationship with the Islamic State grew, I think the name that you will find them most commonly called is the Islamic State Mozambique. They had been initially part of the broader Central African province, but eventually developed their own province. And so now you have the Islamic State Mozambique. That's probably the name that you'll hear most frequently out in the world. But truly, it seems like every day there's a new name depending on.
I've also heard it called Ashabab. Is that the same with Ashabab in Somalia? Is that different?
Completely different. In this case, because so many of the members of this group were just local youth, people would call them Shabab because they're youth. But they are not affiliated, they're not a branch, nothing to do necessarily with the group in Somalia.
So this group, have they, so even if we understand that the region where they come from, it's one that has been excluded, you know, they have legitimate grievances. Have they expressed any, maybe in the document, official statement to say, this is what we want? Do they have a creed? Do they have a declaration of what they're fighting for, what they want? Have they made any claims?
This has been another interesting aspect of this group, because normally when you look at, in theory, the way an insurgency develops, there is a point early on where they do just as you described. They publish a manifesto in the hopes of attaining greater support locally and internationally, finding like-minded folks who will contribute whatever is necessary for the cause, personnel, money, what have you. This group has been a little bit different. They've been during that period where one would expect a lot of publicity, they were low profile. We see occasionally in those early days some video, very low quality video of them speaking to groups where they talk about fight. And this is something that, again, they'll mention in meetings with locals and interactions with individuals that eventually makes it out into the world. A desire, they represent themselves as advocates of the people in a place where the government makes its money off the backs of the poor, particularly the Muslim poor. They're they exist to fight for the people's rights. The vision is to form their own caliphate, and we have recently seen some efforts at governance at a very small scale. But that's the end game that they share with the people as they meet. A lot of their propaganda, when you see the propaganda associated with this group, it comes from the Islamic State's media channels. This group themselves stays very local, communicating verbally, occasionally through graffiti. Lately, they've also been publishing or posting notes around places where they've been, informing people of taxes that they're imposing and why they're imposing the taxes. But their creed and manifesto has been pretty low profile and very targeted to their local audience.
So we've seen, so it's quite interesting. Maybe a bit of an irony. So we see Elion with the group in the Sahel, with Boko Haram. We saw a lot of popular support where the people kind of understand and share empathy with what the group stands for, what they aim to fight for, until they turned against the people and started killing civilians. Well, in Mozambique, we've seen a lot of civilians have been killed, and it's quite, you know, from 2017 to now, it's quite a small distance of time. Is there any kind of popular support? Is what I'm trying to get at. Or at any point in time, was there any popular support for this group?
That is a very important and interesting question. What we've seen, a lot of ups and downs in the relationship between this group and the civilians. On occasion, you'll hear these very heartwarming stories of where they paid for elderly folks to evacuate villages. They gave them the money so that they could get out of harm's way. But those stories have been quite rare. What we saw initially was a very concerted effort to just move civilians out of the way, to avoid the situations where they could potentially provoke a strong reaction from civilians. Governance is tricky. Keeping civilians in the area and trying to manage them, you don't know which way that's going to go. That takes some risks. So what we saw them was avoiding that risk altogether and really encouraging and pushing and forcing people out of the way. The consequence of that, however, was a loss of resources. Even if people weren't specifically supportive, they nonetheless had their little farms. They had economic activity that the insurgents could take advantage of. But with the movement of people out of the areas where they operated, they lost a lot of that. So what we've seen in recent months is an effort to repair that relationship, to go into villages and not steal, but pay at high prices for things that they need. There was some interesting video and footage of them in a town back in February, walking around with children and with women and trying to be part of the community. But that, I think, has produced mixed results. You still see people fleeing by the thousands. Even at the mere rumor that insurgents were coming, they would flee by the thousands. So there is definitely a very damaged relationship. I think to some extent their message perhaps does resonate, but the way they carry it out, the violence against the civilians, has likely reached a point where that relationship is also broken and will be very difficult to repair.
We can't ignore the you know, what you rightly stated when you're talking about the legitimate notion or the argument that this region has been, you know, neglected for long compared to the South. What I was going to say, if you look at it in terms of the long history of conflict in Mozambique, the, you know, the civil war and all of that, the political situation, how much does that play into this current conflict? Is it totally separate from it, or does it tie into this current in any way?
I think there is, like you say, we can't ignore it. It may not be a specific driving force, but definitely it has a strong influence. Interestingly enough, this province, Cabo Delgado, is where the revolution against Portuguese rule began. Interestingly enough, the president of Mozambique is from this province. He is from a separate area from where this insurgency started. He represents sort of the in-group, whereas the insurgents will represent themselves as the out-group.
The out-group.
So those sort of the way the politics developed in the country after the War of Independence and then the Civil War does have an impact on the politics of this conflict. The sense that, so to take a step back, when we look, for example, at the War of Independence, it started in Cabo Delgado, but the primary fighters were of the Makonde ethnic group. These are the people who now receive pensions for their service during that conflict. Less involved, or at least benefiting less from these pensions and other political and economic benefits, are the Mweni people, the people along the coast who formed the initial backbone of this insurgent group. So right there, we start seeing how this historic conflict fed into some of the pre-existing political and economic divisions in the province. Renamo tends to do well in this province. The group that subsequently, when there was a civil war in Mozambique, the opposition group it tends to do well politically in this province, but in an environment where political freedoms are somewhat restricted, where elections aren't always conducted in the most transparent manner, it's easy to see how one might feel their political voice is not being heard when Frelimo, the ruling party, continues to win in the province. So again, these things are sort of dancing at the margins, but definitely having an important influence in the development of the conflict and the grievances that drive the conflict.
So what we've seen definitely, like every other conflict, this conflict has created some humanitarian crisis. And but again, we also see that there's a political economy to it. Like Riley pointed out, it wasn't until this group attacked Parma, it wasn't until they struck at the heart of those interests that we begin to see this. So what is the scale of this, or what is this? Can you talk about the political economy of this conflict? Because it's easy to look at the humanitarian side and then conceal the political economy that drives this. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, the humanitarian impact has been significant. I think some estimates are on the order of close to 1 million or more displaced. It's important to note that during this conflict, there have also been 2 major storms, typhoons that came through and caused additional damage and economic disruption and humanitarian issues. The humanitarian crisis is a very serious one, and we consistently see aid organizations commenting in the press that they're without funds and without resources to meet the need of the people in the province. We often, especially early on, people would just go stay with host families in host communities rather than go to displacement camps, although there were people in displacement camps as well. And while initially this was a great example of a community coming together to support one another, over time, we saw the strains on host communities that themselves were a bit short on resources. Again, still the same province that suffers from all the issues we've discussed earlier about economic and education and all the things. So we saw greater strain on these host communities. We saw displaced camps that weren't quite adequate to meet the needs of the people in them. So as security started to improve in some of these areas with the intervention of the Rwandan forces and the SADC forces, even though it wasn't perfect, even though security wasn't assured and government services were largely absent, people started to return to their homes in the expectation that, well, at least I can farm my plot of land, at least I'll have some food, and I'll be in a more peaceful environment than I am in some of these communities. With the resurgence of insurgent activity, although it is farther south than where we initially saw them, we are still seeing again a new wave of displacements as people fear even just the thought that they're coming to their town. Mm-hmm. And even in areas where people have returned, we're starting to see movement once again. So it's this constant movement of people to displace to new areas, returning to their home areas, but still with a different set of needs. It's created a lot of pressure on the humanitarian aid community, in large part because the state presence has always been weak and it has not improved significantly, even with the introduction of these foreign forces and the beginnings of some stabilization in these areas. So there is a lot of economic disruption. Local businesses, this is something that doesn't always make it into the headlines. There was a lot of talk on the impact on Total with the suspension of the LNG project, but what about all those local businesses that were supporting that project? And we've had business community leaders speak repeatedly about the debt that people have incurred, the economic disruption to these people who were in a pretty stable place otherwise until these projects were suspended. So we've seen pretty widespread economic impact in the province throughout sort of the layers of economic activity.
So, but one thing that amazes me is before this conflict, for the longest, for over 2 decades, Mozambique was seen as one of the fastest growing economy. And but how did it squander that? What were the factors that were leading, that led to that? And how did they manage the economic sources or economic prosperity that they enjoyed at the time?
Well, I think when we talk about that period of growth, we're really talking about southern Mozambique. And again, that kind of feeds into this inequality, that inequality grievance that comes up in this conflict. Southern Mozambique, that's where the weight of the country is. If you look at a map, the capital is at the very tippy south. It could not be farther from Cabo Delgado unless we moved it into a different country altogether. There is this sense that Cabo Delgado is it's its own entity. When you even look at, there are few roads that connect the north to south. A lot of it is just east to west. So it's very cut off. It's a community, as I said, that's predominantly Muslim, that where Portuguese is not very widely spoken. It's Swahili and other local languages. And interestingly enough, this sense of division, this sense that of exclusion is so deep that when you, early on, there were complaints from locals that all the jobs for the LNG were going to foreigners. And in this group of foreigners are Southern Mozambicans. They aren't necessarily seen, they're seen as different. And it's been an issue for the military as well and the police, who are largely staffed with Southerners who go up to this province and they don't speak the language. They can't communicate very easily with locals and are seen almost as a foreign force themselves. So again, when we talk about all this development, it was concentrated on the south. The north didn't see that much of benefit. It's still the province, Cabo Delgado is still, and all three northern provinces, but Cabo Delgado in particular, the place where illiteracy is the highest, where the poverty rate is the greatest, or and economic inequality is the greatest. It didn't see as much of that benefit because it's so not part of sort of the bigger, I guess, political picture, if you will.
I think this also speaks to some of the colonial legacies that maybe they inherited kind of like political structure or that kind of stuff. But if you then look at it, you mentioned earlier that Renamo, functions in those, areas where they feel excluded. And so what is the composition of Renamo? Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is, do they have components from Cabo Delgado within Renamo's leadership or within Renamo's kind of like operation?
I am less familiar with the structure of Renamo. I think when you look at the areas where this conflict has been the hottest, these are areas that have not really benefited as much from Frelimo. And so there's an appeal for a non-Frelimo entity. So I think that's more of where, I think that's a big part of that, of the opposition party's sort of popularity or influence in that area. I'm less well-versed on its composition.
Okay, that makes sense. I think that sort of feeds into the political economy. But if we look at the government forces themselves, it does seem that in places where this happened, that there's always there where the general security forces is always very weak to control things, and then they have always relied on external forces and all of that. So like you mentioned, we've seen the Rwanda forces and the sort of how much success, because I think they initially created a security that guaranteed people coming back, but we've also seen, like Riley said, crisis creeping up again. So how would you assess the military response in terms of from SODOC, from Rwanda? How would you assess it?
It's been complicated. You've mentioned these three. There are other armed actors as well. The government has also, we've seen develop different local forces, local militias, some of which the government has actually officially sanctioned as part of their security response. Some are more informal. So it's a very complicated picture of armed actors in this province. I think in terms of introducing security and stability, in terms of developing a positive relationship with the civilians, the Rwandans have probably shown the greatest success, if you will. The areas where they were deployed purposely to Palma, to Mocimboa da Praia, a very important port town that the insurgents had controlled for about a year when the attack on Palma occurred. And they were very quick and efficient in clearing those areas and holding them. They speak Swahili. They went out and spoke to civilians. They would hang out with the moms as they were making dinner, and they produced beautiful videos to show the public how they were being so successful with the civilians. They've helped reopen schools. And again, we've seen lovely pictures of them holding children with books, creating a very positive image of what they've done in the province. And to be fair, we haven't really heard complaints from civilians. If anything, what often comes out is there will be a conflict between civilians and the Mozambican armed forces, and they'll turn to the Rwandans to intervene and to mediate that dispute. So they seem to have done quite well in the areas where they were deployed. And when we've seen other, for example, there was an instance where the insurgents started creeping closer to mining interests in the south. And again, we saw a deployment of Rwandans quickly into that area. So they've been done well. They've been pretty reliable. The SADC forces, and one other note I should add, is that they were very warmly welcomed. This was a bilateral agreement that the Mozambican government and the Rwandan government concluded together, sort of kind of quietly, and it was done. The SADC is a much different story. This deployment was difficult. It was the result of many months of meetings and summits, some of which were canceled, some were rescheduled, that were very contentious as the SADC countries, South Africa in particular, really pressured Mozambique to accept foreign forces, like, you guys do not have this, you need our help. And the Mozambican government was very adamant that they would drive this response in their country. And they would make the decision, oh, you want to help? That's great. Why don't you give us some weapons? That's what we need. But that wasn't what they got. Once we had that attack in Palma, there was no more resisting. So they acquiesced to having this deployment. But in one last stroke of, I'm in charge, they had the Rwandans come first. The summit where they were going to finalize these details was canceled when NUSI went to Rwanda and finalized those details. And then the SADC forces came, much to the great consternation of some of the leaders of the organization, that this is the order of events. So they've been deployed in less high-profile areas. Their record has been a little bit more mixed. You see more complaints from civilians that they weren't as responsive as they would have liked, a sense that perhaps the insurgents were less afraid of them. But nonetheless, as we speak about their departure, we are seeing an uptick in attacks. We are hearing stories of people, of meetings where SADC leaders are saying, okay, well, we're leaving now, and civilians expressing regret at their departure. And that leaves us then with the Mozambican forces, which have a much more checkered record than either of the external actors, which is quite worrisome because at the end of the day, the Mozambican government is right. It is their responsibility to determine the response in their country. It is their responsibility to drive what's happening there. And they can't outsource it to these countries. They really need to develop their own response. They need to get their forces in order to handle their security. And we haven't quite seen that they haven't quite reached that level yet. We still, even as recently as February, during this recent wave of attacks, heard stories of troops fleeing, an attack on a barracks where, again, they had to flee, and some died, and the insurgents were able to take, you know, stuff from the barracks, equipment and whatnot. We still hear stories of attacks, not attacks, but harassment on civilians, and to some extent, reports of attacks too on fishermen and whatnot. So their record is not good, and it doesn't seem to be improving to the level that is required to backfill these foreign forces as they leave. And that's probably the most worrisome part of the story, because these foreign actors, they're there because it's in their national interest today. Is it going to be in their national interest tomorrow? And then where does that leave the Mozambicans if something happens and we see a reduced presence of even the Rwandan forces?
I was going to ask, thank you. You mentioned national. I was going to ask something as well. Let me just take you up on that in terms of national interest. So we're seeing in Rwanda where there are intervention in places like DRC is not, it's not one that is altruistic. It's one that is driven by maybe the need for resources to mineral resources. Does that play in this Mozambique intervention? Do we see where intervention is driven by strategic interests of these countries? It's because we've seen it, we've also seen it in Somalia at the moment. So the people are taking sides based on, you know, historical friendship or based off maybe Eritrea-Ethiopia conflict, or, you know, people are taking such Egypt siding with, you know, based off their relationship with Ethiopia. Does that play any impact in the decision to intervene in these places?
I think in the Mozambican case for now, probably the clearest interest is an opportunity for Rwanda to flex its muscle, to show the world how capable it is as a peacekeeping force, as an intervening force. I think that is a very, especially when you look at some of the, like, the pictures in the video that show how well they're doing and how they're interacting with civilians. It's a very good PR opportunity. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of discussion, however, about some of the darker sides of this intervention, of extradition agreements between Rwanda and Mozambique regarding Rwandans in Mozambique. You had a lot of people there, Rwandans there, who are not in favor with the government and who are now at risk of being sent back to Rwanda or experiencing some other kind of difficulty in Mozambique. They're less safe, perhaps, than they used to be. There's also talk of to what extent Rwanda might benefit from the LNG once it gets up and running again, especially given its presence in that area. Occasionally you'll hear stories that Rwandan security groups, like private security, are getting contracts and benefiting in these ways. That's actually been one of the biggest criticisms of this deployment, was just how under the radar it was done. And a very deep concern among Mozambican civil society members that there's more to the story than meets the eye, and that Mozambique may eventually end up paying a pretty steep price for this intervention. But some of these details, again, remain to be revealed.
Yeah, it does seem like, it's quite amazing. Like, I did an interview on the Somalia and Ethiopia. It does seem that even within the continent, there's a drive for hegemony. There's a drive for, you know, whether it's Ethiopia, whether it's Rwanda in the Horn, East Africa. But I've not seen much of that drive in West Africa, for instance. I've not seen where Nigeria is pulling its muscle, flexing or trying to. It's quite surprising that I've not seen that. But there's something you mentioned about, so the Mozambique Armed Forces, I think they've received some kind of like training and from the EU. How much impact is that going to make moving forward?
They have received training. There are units, Marines, I believe, who have received training from the EU. There are military units that have received training from the US. I believe Rwanda was going to provide some training to the police. And in a recent statement to the media, some Rwandan officials indicated they would provide training to the military as well. There are a couple of issues here. So these are different actors providing training, and I don't know that they always coordinate. So there's a bit of stovepiping within the military, and I think some of it is quite purposeful on the side of the Mozambican military. And so it's unclear to what extent this training is compatible with each other. To what extent will these units collaborate at all? What the impact is on the overall organization. Fundamentally, even if we have a few units that are quite capable, we still have the issue of the fundamental sort of culture and structure and operation of the military. We still hear reports that soldiers in Cabo Delgado aren't being paid. For many people joining the military, it is a requirement. Not everybody necessarily pursues that requirement, but many who do are kind of looking for a stable job. It's not necessarily a patriotic motivation. It's more of a financial concern, which again, kind of tinkers with your mindset when you aren't really getting paid and you're in a place where it's quite foreign to where you are from. We still hear reports of lack of shortages of just equipment, of uniforms, low morale, and these sort of issues. So there really needs to be a sort of an overhaul of the military to create a long-term strategy, to create a culture where the military isn't serving the seating government, it's serving the people. Where if you violate someone's human rights, you are most certainly held accountable. And civilians see that they can trust their security services to protect them and their interests and not other things. So this training, while beneficial perhaps to the units that are receiving it, it still doesn't address these more fundamental issues that will be necessary to address for sort of the long-term success of the security services.
But you don't think that the overwhelming approach is quite a militarized one? Is there other non-militarized approach that have been deployed to this issue?
And this is the big, big issue. Having all these additional forces come in, all this talk about the military really obscures the second half of the story, which you just raised, the need to address these non-security issues that are so important to the trajectory of this conflict. It's not just about killing combatants. They can be replaced, even leaders, as we saw in August, one of the most high profile leaders of this organization was killed. That didn't really, someone else came in and they've carried on and they launched these elaborate attacks. And we've seen this like new strategy with civilians. There's always often someone to come in behind to carry on the fight so long as there is a reason to fight. And focusing on the fundamental grievances of this conflict is really important, but it's something that's been really neglected. The government has set up organizations, government entities that are supposed to be focused on the economic development of northern Mozambique, writ large, not just Cabo Delgado, but the neighboring provinces as well. And that entity has really had struggled to get off the ground and to really make an impact. And so we're a bit stuck. This military strategy is not the answer. Studies of insurgencies since World War II show that the countries that are most successful in rolling back the insurgency and reestablishing governance are the ones that have a multifaceted approach that, yes, deals with the security issues, but also deals with the economic issues, the political issues, the social issues that are underpinning the conflict and giving people a reason to get involved.
Interesting. It's quite, because I'm quite, and that's quite disappointing to be honest, because the story you're telling is you could just remove the name and put the Nigerian case study and it would just apply. So it's very, very, it's the same issue, what goes on, low morale with the soldiers and, you know, that divorce between, you know, the civil military relations and stuff like that. But if we come to this group itself, how is it getting funded? Though it has affiliations to ISIS, but ISIS Central itself has been weakened, you know, in the last few years. We've had they've been stronger in Africa. We've had, you know, with the provinces. So where is it getting the support? Is it getting external support? Where are the people supporting this group?
That's a very hot topic that many people have tried to research and discover. It seems like they really just live off the local economy and whatever they can obtain from the local economy. People who have left, who have been held hostage. In fact, there was a hostage release not too long ago as part of Ramadan. And those folks have reported that a lot of poverty and suffering in insurgent camps. We often see reports of them, if not buying stuff, then stealing things. Some of the founding members were businessmen, traders. So perhaps that's something that they can still leverage. We hear reports that they try to plot land and grow their own food and basically live off the local economy. People have looked into their role in the illicit economy, and it doesn't seem to be as important of a factor as one would expect. It's not like the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia that completely thrived off the cocaine trade. This group doesn't seem to be quite as deep in the pockets. Although, again, it's interesting that they were able to pay such high prices for local goods. But research into their funding really points to a very contained local unit. because as you said, the Islamic State, it's an interesting relationship with its provinces. It seems like the key contribution it provides is some learning and the propaganda, making the local group seem like a much bigger deal than it would have otherwise.
Yeah, it does seem to me that the group in Mozambique is one that can be contained with a much intentional, non-aggressive, non-military way. I think it's one where it does remind me of, again, Boko Haram in its early stages, before it becomes hijacked by, you know, more global stuff. But if we go back to the elections and look at, you know, with Renamo and Frelimo and all of this situation, look at the peace deal. It does seem to me, again, if I go to the colonial legacies and look at how it creates all is that North-South divide. And I wanted to ask you, how, in your own opinion, how can we, what are the potential solutions to these issues? How can we deal with these issues to get more long lasting? So let's say, how can we do in the immediate, medium term, and long term way? How can we achieve a solution to it? Because it does seem to me that this is still one that can be, you know, maybe not nipped in the bud at this time. We've had, but at least I still see it as one that is, like Riley said, not very advanced and sophisticated.
Yes, and this is a tricky question too, because people have floated the idea of like, oh, let's just negotiate with them. But like, actually, like, who would you negotiate with? Like, who has that authority? And because they've been a bit vague about what they want, like, what are we negotiating? I think an important first step, and again, it's like a long-term ideal solution, not going to happen tomorrow probably, but I think it is that political liberalization, that giving people the confidence that their vote matters and conducting votes in a way where their voice is heard. Because I think that underpins a lot of the complaints, a lot of the grievances, the sense that, oh, I don't have access to economic opportunities like these folks do. Oh, my faith has been corrupted because of this political relationship. Everyone in the South is benefiting and I'm just up here in the North. So how do you, I think one way to sort of start stitching up these threads, maybe an important step would be allowing people confidence in their vote, and maybe the ruling party loses, but at least people have a little bit of faith restored in the system. I think the economic opportunities is an important one too. And it's a tricky one because, again, we're dealing with a community that hasn't had as many educational opportunities, that perhaps is legitimately not qualified for some of the positions that they'd aspired to achieve. So I think, again, improving education, improving economic opportunities for people who have been marginalized historically, I think will be important too in kind of restoring faith in the system. But it's a very long process, and one that I think every day gets pushed back a few more years when you think of all the displacements, all the schools that have been closed, all the traumas that these children have experienced. Even if we just give up on the present generation, like, okay, well, the kids will figure it out. I don't know how they'll figure it out if they haven't been to school, if they have been traumatized and aren't receiving the support they need, if we're in an environment now where previously people maybe they were different, but they kind of got along and carried on their lives in peace side by side. But now we don't have that peaceful coexistence anymore. And to what extent has that bled into society and frayed sort of the things that kept society together? So it seems like there should be a fairly simple solution. Like, let's have free elections. Let's have a security force that's respectful of locals and that is there to serve the people. But these simple solutions will take a very long time, I think, to develop and require some pretty significant changes at the core of the country to put in place.
Well, you've rightly mentioned these things, and they look simple, but they're not far-fetched. To be honest, the things you've mentioned are not far-fetched, but they get complicated with each passing day as people get displaced and people don't get this. There has to be a long-term plan for this. Well, I have to let you go. It's early. We really enjoyed this the situation. But I guess before I let you go, I was going to ask, if that is the long-term plan, people want to say, before we get to the long-term plan, what is the bridge? What needs to be done now?
What needs to be done now? I think first and foremost, starting to address, as you mentioned, those non-military issues. I think that is such an important first step. Having the state provide aid, or at least, because in some cases, I think sometimes the state seems like an obstacle with the red tape to get humanitarian aid, with reports of corruption in the distribution of aid. Even just helping people see the state as an ally, having a positive state presence in these areas, addressing these fundamental grievances, reopening the schools, providing that trauma support to people who have really suffered, providing economic opportunities and a measure of stability, addressing sort of the issues that are dividing communities today. And then at the same time, though, of course, continuing that military pressure on the insurgents, but in a way that isn't harmful to civilians, in a way that shows civilians the state is their partner and is there to defend them and to protect them, I think would be another important first step. And just fundamentally having the state own this and lead this and make it very clear that they indeed run the show and that aren't outsourcing everything to foreign troops or to foreign aid organizations and foreign governments, to really show leadership and coordination of all these different moving parts, to show the locals that they are the state, they are the government, and that they're there as a service to them.
I agree with you 100%. And I think one of the things that is coming out, even from my own research, is that the state in the continent, it's not a neutral or impartial entity. It's actually one that is a purveyor of violence. And we had one person on the one of the episodes that was looking at peacekeeping missions, and you know, one of his criticism is the quest for stabilization, the drive, you know, in the last how many years, maybe post-Cold War, we've seen, you know, that shift towards stabilizing this place rather than dealing with root causes. That in itself also kind of like disincentivizes the state from taking ownership or leadership of this, and their responsibilities externalized, and they feel, and then they gain credibility from they say, we're not doing well, we're getting help from they gain credibility by such external support and everything. So well, we only can be optimistic and hopeful that, you know, some of these things you've recommended will be taken on board. Emilia, thank you very much for joining me this early. And I'll keep you posted once the episode is ready to be aired, and would encourage you to share among your network. And hopefully we'll call you again in the future if the situation develops any further. But for now, thank you for this very exciting and interesting conversation.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed being here, and I hope we talk again soon.
Yeah, me too. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in today for yet another exciting episode. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I do. I want to encourage you to hit the subscribe button, like and share our videos, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.